Court is now in session, please be seated.
Good morning, Council. Mr. Chief Justice, fellow justices, I just rise to introduce, as I have on a prior occasion, Mark Whitkin, who will be presenting the argument.
Thank you.
Welcome again.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, John Hendershot for the appellant. I rise to reintroduce to the Court Mr. John Ann Thomas of the Morgan Lewis firm, who will present for us.
Welcome.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be back. When we were here in May, I argued that trying to certify class action for plaintiff's breach of contract claim was like trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. Well, nothing's changed in the last 7 months that would alter that reality. That's true notwithstanding the remand. This court sent the case back to the trial court so that it could clarify its decision on four key points. Unfortunately, the supplemental opinion, which consists mostly of a rehash of the procedural history, comes up short. The analysis is conclusory and plainly wrong. And it's also true, notwithstanding the plaintiff's latest and after the 11th hour change of theories. To be sure, plaintiff's most recent theory on predominance is too late, but it's also too little. We have the same round hole, which is Rule 23, in the law that interprets it, and the same square peg, which is plaintiff's ill-fitting and ill-conceived breach of contract claim. So we're left, as we were before, with four reasons to deny certification. Number one, individual issues regarding fact of injury predominate. Two, plaintiffs have not met their burden on typicality. Three, plaintiffs face an insurmountable conflict which prevents them from adequately representing the putative classes. And as before, four, because of the predominance of individual issues, a class action is not manageable and therefore cannot be superior. Now, as before, the starkest and most clearly dispositive issue, problem the plaintiffs face is predominance, which requires a rigorous analysis far more demanding than that for Rule 23A, commonality. And there are four basic points which are not disputed. First, this is an action governed by New York law. The contract the plaintiffs sue under says so. Second, under New York law, to establish a breach of contract, in addition to proving the existence of the contract and a breach of that contract, the plaintiff must also establish the fact of injury. Third, fact of injury is a distinct question for the measure of damages. And fourth, where fact of injury cannot be proven on a class-wide basis, then individual questions predominate, thus precluding certification under Rule 23B3. Now, the Orthocraft decision from the Eastern District of New York, among other cases, makes those points clear. Now, against that backdrop, the analysis here, which is greatly aided by on-point authorities, isn't that difficult. And having never squarely addressed the logic of our analysis before, which is supported by unrebutted expert reports and the law, the plaintiffs now on remand throw out their latest, the so-called POP theory. It's a theory we believe was raised too late and that the trial court should not have considered. But in any event, it's a theory that's not supported by a single authority and which, while it sounds catchy, changes absolutely nothing. And that's true for one very simple reason. Injury in fact, which is what the plaintiffs must establish on a class-wide basis, by definition requires a customer to have in fact been injured. A presumed or hypothetical injury doesn't cut it. And that's the unmistakable upshot of Newton from the Third Circuit and Huang, both of which are express that injury in fact, fact of injury, requires actual economic loss. In short, you need an actual injury, or phrased otherwise, an economic loss to satisfy the injury in fact requirement. And plaintiff's so-called POP theory is the antithesis of an injury in fact. It's nothing more than hypothetical. The basic points are instructive. The price of a stock on the initial day of trading is irrelevant to any customer who did not in fact trade that day, or at least intend to trade that day. And there are no allegations in this complaint that any class member, let alone any named plaintiff, actually entered the market on the first day of trading and purchased shares at the POP price or any other price, or would have sold at the POP price had he or she received an allocation. But as such, the POP price is no more relevant than any other price on any other day. And just as customers who did receive allocations but who did not sell at the pop price saw no benefit as a result of the pop price, then customers who did not receive allocations and who did not enter the marketplace and purchase at the pop price could not have been harmed by it. Rather, it remains true, as we have said all along, that whether these customers were injured in fact and thus suffered an actual economic loss turns on whether they would have made or lost money on the allocations.
Is it possible to define the class in that way, then, that it actually consists of people, not the all customers, but the customers for whom there was injury in fact?
Can you repeat the question?
Is it possible that there's a smaller class within the alleged putative class here of those who had injury in fact, and should the matter be permitted to proceed as to that smaller class?
I think if what you're suggesting is defining the class so as to include those injured in fact,
yes,
would be to include in the class an element of the class that would have to be first proven, that would be a merits-based definition which would presuppose the liability for inclusion. I don't think that would work.
How does that follow? Why would you have to have a merits-based determination in order to define the class as those persons who actually suffered an economic injury because they were not allowed to sell at the pop price and would have, they purchased at the pop price and were denied benefit of the spread because they didn't get that allocation?
Well, as I understand the proposed definition, it would be that there was a contractual obligation that was breached, that but for the breach, the customer would have received the allocation and who were injured because of that breach. The only thing left in that definition is calculating damages. I think if you put all those elements into the definition, that would result in a merits-based definition. I know we argued that.
But that's true. Like in that sense, every class determination is a merits-based determination. Because until the court finds, and unless the court finds, that there is liability on the merits, it doesn't matter what the class definition is.
As I understand it, if the definition requires to conclude whether someone's in the class, a resolution of the merits first, that's a merits-based definition.
Correct. But why is that the case here?
That's how I understood the proposed change to the class definition. Perhaps I'm misplaced, but as I understood the definition, as I said before, it was essentially every element but measuring damages would have to be established to determine who's in it. Because unless they could demonstrate that they were injured, in fact, they wouldn't be in the class.
It sounds like you're putting the rabbit in the hat. I mean, whether or not there was a misallocation or a non-allocation, a culpable non-allocation of IPO securities is something that would be tried in due course. And meanwhile, the definition, the definition would stand out there contingent on the results of the trial. But I don't understand why you would have to have a trial first before you could then define a class. That is, if the trial does result in liability as to one or more of the subclasses, then those persons who meet the description, whether they be a lot or a few, would recover. Why? How does that become a merits-based determination?
I guess point out that the clock isn't on here, so I'm really sure where I am at the time.
Well, I'm glad you pointed that out, but I will figure out where you are.
Okay. I'm sure he'll shut me up when the time comes. I'm trying to connect here. It seems to me what is being proposed, though, is a definition, and at the end of the process, if you prove all those elements, then you know who's in the class and who's not in the class as a result of the resolution of the merits of the definition. That, as I understand it, is a classic merits-based class. Now, it's our position, and it remains true as it always has, that whether customers were injured in fact and thus suffered an actual economic loss turns on whether they would have made or lost money from the denied allocations. If they would have lost money, then under New York law, they'd have no actual loss and they would have no claim. And the analysis rests on whether or not they would have made or lost money, as it always has, on when they would have sold their shares, which, as we have always said, and which is not open for serious question, would require a customer-by-customer analysis. If this were just a single plaintiff case, and Mr. Benning were the only plaintiff, what would he have to prove to win? Of course, he'd have to establish that there were certain allocation rules that Wood Capital was obliged to follow. He'd have to prove that they breached those rules, and he'd have to prove that but for the breach of those rules, he would have received an allocation. But none of that would matter unless he could go on to establish that because of the breach,
perhaps I'm missing something, but doesn't this customer-by-customer analysis occur only at the claims stage? That is, at the stage where, assuming that there is a liability determination, those persons who consider themselves as qualified members of the class file a proof of claim.
Injury, in fact, is part of the liability phase, and that is what's required to be established to establish liability. And what we're saying, the only way to determine injury in fact, at the liability phase is to find out when people would have sold the securities to see if they would have made or lost money. That's individual. Now, because a customer could make or lose money, the only way that Mr. Benny, for example...
So you're saying, basically, that the fact of injury in a case like this is always individual, and because fact of injury is a component or element of liability, what you're doing is sweeping individual inquiries and determinations into a determination of liability, which I guess by, you know, that analysis would always have to precede the determination of the class. That is, it's the individual character of the fact of loss that creates the predominance problem and in turn creates a merits-based class definition problem.
I'm not sure about the second piece of that, but the first point is our argument. You've articulated it, yes. Now, when I was last here, I argued that the Newton and Huang decisions were on point, and I submit that they're conclusively instructive. Once again, Huang is our case. In both cases, the customers were seeking to engage in securities transactions. In both cases, the customers were unable to do so because of alleged breaches by the online brokerage firm. In both cases, customers could establish a claim only if they could show that they would have made money from the lost opportunity. And in both cases, making that determination will require inquiry in the facts and circumstances for each customer. Here, that's figuring out when they would have sold. And because of that, the Ohio court reversed an erroneous trial court decision which had certified a class, and in so doing, relied on the same principal authority we did, which is Newton. Now, plaintiffs, of course, have no authority whatsoever for their POP theory, and they have no authority which calls into question either Newton or Frank. And there is yet another reason why the POP theory has no place in this analysis. It's also perhaps the reason why plaintiffs never raised it in any of the 10 briefs they filed on certification prior to remand, and that is that the plaintiffs affirmatively pleaded that they held their IPO shares for 60 days. Well, if that's true, then the IPO price on the first day of trading is by definition of no significance to the injury in fact analysis. And the bottom line is that lost opportunity, which is all the plaintiffs are really talking about, does not get the job done. As stated in Huang, the law doesn't recognize inchoate claims. And I submit that is exactly the right result, because what we're talking about is injury in fact, not hypothetical or presumed injury. And just a few words about the trial court's supplemental opinion. There's very little analysis on this point in it. What's there is wrong. First, the trial court held that fact of harm, fact of injury, is determined at the time of the breach. And second, the court held that whether a customer would have sold at a profit or a loss is a measure of damages issue. Now, there's no authority cited for either of the conclusions, and in any event, they're backwards. Whether someone would have sold at a profit or a loss goes to whether that person was or was not injured. It's not a measure of damages question, but rather, like in Newton and in Huang, it's a question of whether the customer has a claim at all. And the only way to resolve the issue of whether or not the person would have made or lost money on a classified basis. You cannot do it on a classified basis. The only way is to ask individual questions. And it's only after that analysis, assuming it proved an actual economic loss and liability, the court would have to go back and wrestle with the separate issue of the measure of damages. How am I doing on my time?
You have 3 minutes and 57 seconds until your rebuttal starts.
About 5 minutes.
Right.
Okay. I'll say a few words about one other issue, and then I'll stop for the last few. Another issue that plaintiffs face, another dispositive problem they face, is the conflict among the subclasses. Rule 23A4 requires the named plaintiffs be able to fairly and adequately represent the interests of the subclass. The named plaintiffs here cannot do that. That's the unavoidable result of the zero-sum nature of the allocation process that they do complain about. For each IPO, there are only so many shares to go around, and none were ever left over. The plaintiff's complaint alleges four different theories as to how the process did not work. Each of the theories competes for pieces of the same pie. The plaintiffs say this is not true for two reasons. The first is, the plaintiffs argue that our position rests on the erroneous assertion that the four classes are defined in reference to four distinct breach of contract claims. The one Bacappi family is the plaintiff's argument. Now, they may believe our position is erroneous, but the trial court made express findings that, number one, the plaintiffs have asserted four theories of recovery, and number two, each of the four theories of recovery involves a separate factual and legal analysis. Their second point is that all four plaintiffs are prepared to have the court apply all the criteria and simply ask the court to apply all the criteria. That may be what the Bennings want and what Ms. Dabler wants, what plaintiff's counsel wants, but certainly not what an adequately represented plaintiff would want. There are four subclasses. A determination that Wood Capital had and breached one of the rules would not determine whether or not Wood Capital had and breached any of the others. Yet there could be no question that the class member would have a better chance of prevailing if he or she could prove that one or more of the other subclasses should not. If the plaintiffs can't decide on behalf of the other subclasses, they would be obliged to represent that they want to prove no fewer than all four, even though the subclass member may have no interest in proving one or more of the others. And the case law we've cited supports the conclusion that class members are competing for the same limited resource that an actual conflict exists which precludes certification. The Yeager's Fuel case from the Eastern District of Pennsylvania and the Outboard Marine case from the District of Delaware support that conclusion. The trial court found that whether some members may recover and others may be found to have benefited, parenthetically, and thus have no claim, is something the trial court will need to sort out when it reaches the issue of the measure of damages. That just misses the point. To prevail in this case, an individual customer will have to prove that he or she would have received the allocation but for the breach alleged in the subclass. And as I stated before, there's no question that a customer will have a better chance of prevailing if he or she can prove that members of one or more of the others should not. That conflict is not about measuring or distributing damages. Rather, it goes directly to whether the subclass members have a claim at all. I'll reserve.
Your Honors, good morning. Mark Ripken on behalf of the plaintiffs in the class. It's a pleasure to be here again. We have, I'm sure you recall, this is really our third trip to the Supreme Court. It's only our second time here for argument, but this has been an extremely protracted class certification proceeding. I would like to respond, of course, to any of the questions the Court may have, but let me begin by discussing some of the points that the Risk Council brought up during the course of the argument. First, Witt has asserted that the plaintiffs don't have the right to address this POP theory of fact of injury. They say that we've never raised it. They say that we waived the right to do so, and they say it's inappropriate for us to do so now. Let me respond to that two ways. If you will recall, when we argued this case the first time, when we argued the original appeal from the court's decision, my argument was entirely that. And I will confess to you that until a question came from this court directed to Wynn's counsel, we on the plaintiff side of this case never really understood the distinction that the defendant was trying to make between fact of injury on one hand and measure of damages on the other. It is an extremely elusive distinction. And the court's questions this morning of Witt's counsel, I think, speak to some of that. When we finally heard for the first time, at least when I finally heard and understood the, what I think is a rather ephemeral distinction that Witt's counsel was trying to make, I understood immediately what the response to that was, and I appreciate very much the court's questioning in that regard and the opportunity to address it. Having done that, the court exercised its discretion and remanded the case back to the Superior Court for supplemental class certification proceedings. You did not ask the court to write an additional opinion. You did not ask the court to consider only additional briefs. You said, hold a supplemental class certification proceeding. We did. We submitted more evidence. We submitted more arguments. Some of them addressed this POC theory for the first time, it is true, after our hearing on the appeal. But it is certainly contemplated that on remand, those very things will happen. We cite two cases in our brief. One is State versus Steen, and the other one is Husband versus Wife, both from this court. And those cases clearly say on remand, the plaintiff is not limited to the record or the arguments made below. In fact, remand is an opportunity for the plaintiff to supplement the record. We've done exactly that. Witt cites two cases that simply don't stand in the way of that. One is Delaware Electric Co-op versus DeFilly, and there the court simply said a party may not make new arguments on appeal that he did not make in the first instance in the trial court. Here we've done that. We discussed it at length, exclusively during my argument here in court. This court remanded back to the Superior Court. It was fully briefed. There was evidence submitted. There was an enormous amount of discussion before Judge Johnston in the Superior Court. The argument has now been made in the court.
Well, moving beyond the question of whether the POP theory is cognizable.
Yes, sir.
Opposing counsel argued that there are at least two problems with it. One is that it's basically not cognizable as a matter of law. That is, under New York law, it doesn't establish fact of harm because it's hypothetical. But secondly, even if that were not the case, it injects into the class definition individual issues which by their nature would predominate over the class issues.
Let me respond to that in several ways. First, I would direct Your Honor's attention to page 4 of the opinion on the appeal, the remand order, where Your Honor's considered and rejected that very argument. The Witt has always said that the definitions of the class here interject merits-based determinations. The court rejected that as an issue and disagreed with Witt's position, and on remand, the instructions to the Superior Court did not include consideration of those issues. That's number one. Number two,
I think this is somehow law of the case.
Well, I think absolutely it's law of the case. I think this court has already spoken on that issue.
But you're telling us that an argument that you raised for the first time when you were asked before us, which hadn't been briefed under New York law or any other law, is not binding.
No, I don't mean to say that the question of the POP theory is law of the case. I don't think that the court accepted the POP theory as a measure of, as an indicia of harm. That's not what I meant to say. What I meant to say is Witt has always said, has always argued, that the definition of the class is impermissibly merits-based. It required the court below and required this court, and then only may require the court below again, to presume the merits of the plaintiff's claim before accepting the definition of the class. Witt has never changed that argument one iota. Your Honors have already rejected that argument. I think that argument applies as well to the POP theory of demonstrating class-wide proof of injury in fact as it does to any other element of the claim. And Witt's counsel very honestly conceded that he thinks that it is impossible to certify a class in this case because these are always merits-based determinations that have to be made, and I respectfully disagree with him.
Maybe we should talk a little bit about what merits-based determination means. Your opponent merits-based class definition.
That is exactly what Witt has argued, and that is exactly what this court has said is not sustainable. That is precisely the argument Your Honor's addressed in the remand order and rejected. And that's my position. I think we're now plowing ground that has already been plowed. With respect to the question of the POP, our position is simply this. The plaintiffs, all of these plaintiffs, affirmatively sought the opportunity to participate in, for the four plaintiffs we represent, 14 IPOs, but for all of the WIT customers they seek to represent, for about 70 IPOs. Four of them affirmatively sought to purchase those shares. All of them were allegedly improperly denied the opportunity to purchase those shares because WIT failed to adhere to four different rules. I think the defendants have said that in order for the court to certify the class, the court would have to make a merits-based determination of all of those four claims. That's one element of the argument that the court has rejected. Which other argument is that just because they were...
Well, when you say we've rejected it, I have the remand order in front of me. Are you relying on the statement WIT Capital cannot oppose class certification based on the presumed outcome of a dismissal motion that did not make... Is that...
No, it's, Your Honor, it's paragraphs. There's... I didn't want to number them five and five, but there's two paragraphs in number five. WIT Capital's, and I'm reading from page four of the order, WIT Capital's first claim of error cannot survive scrutiny because it boils down to an unsupported assertion that before any of the four subclasses can be certified, the trial court would first have to determine whether the legal theory upon which each of the four respective subclasses is based states a cognizable claim for breach of contract. And then in the second paragraph, number five, the court says, although WIT Capital's legal reasoning is correct, its premise is not, and then proceeds to explain why the court is rejecting that argument. That's their merit-based argument, and that's what the court previously said. I think the second point of all of this is that having demonstrated now that in 13 of the 14 IPOs, and we concede that in one of them, in the iLife IPO, there was no POP, so that case is not part of the class. But in 13 of the 14 IPOs, the IPO price was substantially below the aftermarket price on the very first day and for some period of time thereafter. We say that it is simply a matter of common sense and logic that if one has the opportunity to buy a good at $12, for example, and then immediately thereafter sell it for $22, but if that opportunity is denied wrongfully, that the person who should have had that opportunity has unquestionably been injured. There is then the next question, which is the question of how do you measure the damages that injured person is entitled to as a matter of law. Witt has consistently blurred the distinction between fact of injury, which I've just addressed, and measuring damages. Although Witt insists that it is making a logical distinction between the two, I have been perplexed by that distinction throughout the case because WIT does not really adhere to the distinction it's drawing. If we simply look at the fact of injury, there is no question. If you are wrongfully denied the opportunity to profit from a venture that you should have the right to profit by, you have been injured in fact, and that is all we said to the Superior Court, and that is exactly what Judge Johnston said in her extremely well-reasoned opinion. The question then becomes the measure of damages, and ultimately that's where we and Witt fundamentally disagree. Witt began the argument by saying that there is one thing that is undisputed, and that's that New York law applies. We do not dispute that. In fact, we cite a case from the New York Appellate Court called Aronick versus Atkin. And in that case, the court determined that the loss of an opportunity to sell shares that the plaintiff should have had is a compensable breach of contract for which the measure of damages is fixed at the time of the breach. The defendant in that case argued that subsequent market movement in the stock would affect the measure of damages that the plaintiff would be entitled to recover. The New York Appellate Court rejected that argument and said exactly that. The measure of damages is determined at the time of the breach. We have addressed that case. We addressed it before Judge Johnston. We address it here in our brief. And we say that under New York law, which Witt insists applies, and we agree, an argument can be made that the measure of damages is exactly the fact of injury. They are not, it turns out that ultimately they are not different. Your Honor, yes, you have a question.
So you're arguing that the other side's position, which is that in order to prove the fact of injury, there must be an actual out-of-pocket economic loss, is not the law of New York.
I am arguing that it is their statement is an incorrect statement of New York law.
So the answer to my question is yes.
I wasn't sure how many negatives there were, but yes. The answer to your question, I think, is yes. Okay. Which response to Atkin, Aronet versus Atkin, is interesting. In their brief, in their reply brief, Witt answers Aronet versus Atkin by saying that's a seller case, not a buyer case. So Witt, citing absolutely no law, says that sellers have one measure of damages available to them under New York law. Buyers have a different measure of damages available to them under New York law. Witt does not cite any law for that proposition. Nor, for that matter, does Witt cite any law for the proposition what measure of damages would be available to a buyer. Now, I think Witt's argument is this. Assume for a moment that you had the right to buy the stock at $12, and assume for a moment that the price went to $22, and assume it went up and down thereafter. In order to prove your damages, you would have to prove when you were going to sell, because Witt would have the opportunity to argue some mitigation of damages. But once again, Witt's argument in this regard is always addressed to a measure of damages. Although it insists that it is arguing fact of injury, it is really arguing damages. And when we looked at the issue of damages under New York law, we found this Aronet versus Atkin case that holds that the subsequent movement of the price of the stock is simply irrelevant. The damages are measured at the time the injured party is denied an opportunity that he or she should have had.
Your position is that the fact of damage and the quantum or measure of damages is indistinguishable because the measure of damages is defined, in effect, by the fact of damage.
It is one of the arguments that
I lost opportunity to make a profit. Creates, that is, defines the profit that would measure the damages.
It is one of the arguments that I made. I have tried scrupulously to answer the question Witt has posed, which is, if we just look at fact of injury, is there fact of injury that's provable on a class-by basis? And I think the POP does that. The fact that these prices rose.
Let's assume that.
Yes, sir.
Then you get to the next argument that the other side advances, which is, well, at the very least, you've got to have a claimant who's willing to swear under oath that, you know, had I had this allocation, I would have sold on the first day at the IPO, the first day after the IPO. That may not be the case. And so, in order to establish that, don't you then get into individual class member issues, which then creates the predominance problem?
Two responses to that. My first response is the obvious one, which I think even Your Honor suggested in a question you asked of Witt's counsel. That's a damages issue. At that point in time, that's a question of damages, which every court that's ever considered class certification has said never stands in the way of certifying a class. If it did, we would never have class actions. It would be impossible for there to be a class action if individual proof of damages precluded a class from being certified, because in almost every case I can think of, different members of a class will have different amounts of damages.
The cash-out mergers, the amount of damages is the same for every share of stock.
That being one example, that's why I said not every case, but most every case I can think of. For example, in a standard stock fraud case, people buy and sell stock at all different points in time during the class. They buy at different prices. The prices at which they buy may be affected by more or less inflation. They sell at all different prices. The prices at which they sell may be affected by more or less inflation. There is always invariably, not always, because you have identified one instance, there's almost always going to be an individual question of damages, and the courts have for 40 years said that doesn't stand in the way of certification.
But if in a proof of claim form, an individual member of a subclass says, no, I wouldn't have sold, if I got my allocation, I would not have sold on the first business day after the IPO. I would have sold on the fifth day. And as a consequence, I wouldn't have gotten X number of dollars. I would have gotten X minus 3 because the market went down, not to the IPO allocation price, but to somewhere below the first day low.
Is
that what you mean?
That is exactly correct, Your Honor. That is exactly correct. On the assumption, and that's my second point, that's on the assumption that the court does not accept our argument regarding New York law. And we addressed this with Judge Johnston because she was interested in this, and we explained to her that...
Well, what is your argument on New York law is that there's an automatic payment of the difference between the IPO allocation price and the first business day's market price?
Our argument is that if the court applies Ehrlich versus Atkin, the court can assess damages and can calculate damages for everybody as the amount of the pop.
Even though it may be hypothetical.
Well, there's nothing hypothetical about pop. We know what the IPO price is.
But there is something hypothetical about the pop being the measure of damages if, in fact, there wasn't a sale in the first business day.
Just like the court rejected the defendant's argument that subsequent price changes in the market did not diminish the seller's damages in Ehrlich versus Atkin, we think this court, probably in the first instance the Superior Court, could very well conclude that subsequent movements in the price of the stock in these IPO cases would not diminish the damages that the buyers would be entitled to. Yes. And what we said there was that question of, and I, by the way, I see my time is nearly up, and I did want to touch on this question of conflict, but that question of measuring damages is itself a question that may very well be determined on a class-wide basis. If the court accepts my argument under New York law,
we went to the lower court, didn't we? I mean, really did this lower court make us to what the New York law was on that point?
I'm not understanding. The lower court in New York?
Yeah. No, the lower court here.
Oh, Judge Johnston said that the court can consider the question of damages on a class-wide basis, and that any difficulty that may arise in connection with the computation of damages is not something that would stand in the way of certifying the claim. She addressed it in her supplemental opinion. So she recognized that she may consider as a common question of fact or law, because that's what Rule 23 says, it is a common question of law that all of the members of the class share, whether the damages measurement in Ehrlich versus Atkin applies to this case. If the lower court accepts that measure of damages, then we don't have any individual proof of damages required because we know that the pop is equal to the damages. On the other hand, Your Honor, as you've suggested, if the lower court concludes that that's not the appropriate measure of damage, then it does open the opportunity for individual class members to submit claims and answer, no, I wouldn't have sold on the first day, I might have sold on the second day, but I certainly would have sold on the third day, and submit a proof of claim. And she said specifically, she says, difficulties to be encountered in calculating individual questions of damages do not rise to a level that would preclude class certification.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Would I be wrong to suggest that at least on the first issue, this boils down to you say that lost opportunity is not appropriate under New York law, and the other side says, in fact, it is?
I say that lost opportunity does not reach the requisite level of an actual injury in fact. It's not an actual economic loss. What we just heard here was really the height turning our respective positions on their head. Our position has been throughout extremely clear that there's a distinction between fact of injury and the measure of damages. We didn't invent the argument. It's based on decisions from the Third Circuit, Newton, as explained in Wang in the case, which is very clear. It's always been our position, and it's very clear from those cases what our position is. The Aaron Act decision counsel has talked about is a measure of damages case. It's not the liability injury in fact case, and his entire argument just now boils down to talking about the measure of damages. It has nothing to do with establishing injury in fact. And indeed, the Aaron Act case is just a measure of damages case. It does not deal with the separate question of how you determine injury in fact on a class-wide basis. It doesn't address that at all. The Orthocraft decision and the Huang decision deal with that. And in any event, the Aaron Act case, the principle of measuring damages at the time of the breach, which is what it talked about, was used to get to the underlying New York principle of putting the plaintiffs in the position they would have been in but for the breach. Well, here, putting the position plaintiffs they would have been in but for the breach can't be looked at by looking at the POP. And that's because they've all pleaded they would have held for 60 days. So since you have to accept that as true, determining damages by looking at the POP by definition can't put them in the position they would have been in. It'd just be a windfall. And they cite no cases whatsoever from any jurisdiction where any court looked at a POP price in an IPO lost opportunity case to measure either measure damages, let alone determine injury in fact. Our argument's not that the POP theory fails because it's merit-based. I talked about that in response to a question. The POP theory fails because it doesn't answer the question which you put to me to begin with, which is that it's not an injury. In fact, the other response to your question about putting the injury into the definition is that you still don't know who's injured in fact, even if you put it into the definition. You still have to figure out who was injured in fact, and as we've said, that requires an individual analysis. And I'll conclude by saying that this case, this six-year-old case, has been on life support for too long. The only thing left in this case is a dubious breach of contract claim barred by the express terms of the contract. It cannot possibly survive the predominance analysis that's required, and that's explained in our briefs and supported by case law, that suffers from an incurable conflict of interest and that lacks the allegations necessary for the plaintiffs to establish typicality. And I suggest that the ever-moving target defenses to these problems proves the point this case is one that should not be certified. I ask the court to reverse. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.
Please rise.